The texts of the Second Vatican Council that deal most specifically with questions of marriage, family, and the significance of human sexuality and those issues of bioethics that pertain to the beginning of life are the sections from Gaudium et Spes, the Pastoral Constitution on the Church in the Modern World, in Part 2, which deals with, as it's described, some problems of special urgency. And beginning with number 46, the Council highlights a number of issues which, if we drop down to number 47, specifically includes the family and marriage in the modern world. In number 47, the Fathers of the Council emphasize that it's not merely a question of whether or not marriage is being highly regarded or properly expressed in modern society. They point to a very fundamental principle that the well-being of society itself is indicated by the healthy conditions of the community produced by marriage and family. So marriage and family are the source of social well-being. If they are not held in high esteem, if there is a low regard for marriage or for the family, then the society, which is the necessary result of the family, is going to be in trouble. And they describe some of the issues that have arisen. I've highlighted in white their concern that the institution is not reflected with equal brilliance, and the Council Fathers list a number of the issues, including polygamy, divorce, so-called free love, relationships without any significant commitment, and various other issues that have effectively diminished the significance of marriage or caused people's consciences to become less clear in the area of committed relationship. Then, if we move down to number 48, we find continuity with the earlier documents that we've already looked at with Arcanum and Casti Connubii, and a list of or a description of the various benefits and purposes of matrimony. And the footnote text there lists the various authors that are being particularly highlighted or particularly emphasized. And the text points out that there are various benefits and purposes and all have a decisive bearing on, and then I've numbered 1, 2, and 3, various characteristics or if you will, effects. The continuation of the human race, the result of fertility, the personal development and eternal destiny of individual members of the family. So not just the spouses themselves, but the family which they create and its connection with the church and with eternity is a part of the benefit and purpose of marriage. And then finally, the dignity, stability, and peace and prosperity of the family itself and of human society as a whole. Again, this theme that the well-being and health of the family is going to be reflected in the well-being and health of the society in which the family takes place. Then, numbers 1 and 2 in the next section, the indented portion, here you have the two traditional ends of marriage. By their very nature, the institution of matrimony and conjugal love are ordained for the procreation and education of children and find in them their ultimate crown. So here again, children are the highest good of marriage. They are the crown of marriage. And number 2, a man and a woman who by their compact of conjugal love are no longer two but one flesh, render mutual help and service to each other through an intimate union of their persons and of their actions. So these two purposes, procreation and union, the act of bringing the family, the extended family, into being, and then the couple's union with one another and the love that that creates and which can then be shared. These two things are mentioned together, but there isn't specific language of higher or lower or superior or inferior. They're highlighted as two aspects and, again, part of the various benefits and purposes. And that isn't to say that there is not a strong emphasis on and even a sense of the highest significance of the dimension of fertility, but the other aspects of marriage are also being highlighted, and as we'll see, this is being brought up to and integrated into a clearer vision of the transcendent and sacramental nature of marriage. So if we move down to the next highlighted paragraph, Christ the Lord abundantly blessed this many-faceted love, welling up as it does from the fountain of divine love and structured as it is on the model of his union with his church. So part of the uniqueness of marriage and its holiness is precisely that it is mirrored in the love of Christ for his church, the context in which the mysterious or sacramental nature is particularly mentioned in the scriptures. And then the lovely text, which is the next highlighted portion, authentic married love is caught up into divine love. So the interrelationship between the spouses is actually a drawing of them into relationship with God. And as we'll see, as this tradition continues, there'll be an emphasis on the idea of the communion of the spouses as a reflection of the communion of persons within the Blessed Trinity itself. And highlighted here, as we mentioned before, is the emphasis on the sacramentality of marriage. The text highlighted in red, for this reason, Christian spouses have a special sacrament by which they are fortified and receive a kind of consecration in the duties and dignity of their state. So the sacrament of matrimony is a strengthening and an opportunity for the spouses to consecrate their tasks, their activities, their work in the context of creating and being part of the family and in being in relationship with one another. So an ennobling of the church's understanding of marriage, a bestowing on it or a highlighting within it its particular transcendent quality. And in the yellow highlighted text, the going on through marriage as a way of sanctification, the couple increasingly advances the perfection of their own personalities as well as their mutual sanctification, and they contribute jointly to the glory of God. So the couple themselves is a reflection of, and indeed contributes to, the glory of God. This powerful ennobling of marriage goes on in number 49 in the text that I've highlighted. Such love, the love between the spouses, merging the human with the divine. So here you have a kind of reference to the mystery of the incarnation, that the couple is a reflection of precisely that mystery which God creates by his outpouring into creation in the Son who is both divine and human. It's mirrored in the love of the spouses who themselves reflect, or as it says here, merge the human with the divine, and are led, the spouses, this leads the spouses to a free and mutual gift of themselves. And here's a reference to Casti Connubii. And this emphasis on the mutual gift of themselves, the gift that we become when we are able to offer ourselves to one another, this becomes one of the unique characteristics of marriage. And here again, in the later theology of the John Paul II, it will be seen as a reflection of the love of God. This capacity for making of oneself, for being made into a one who can freely give the gift of self to the other, is one of the things that makes us uniquely human. Then in the next highlighted text, a particular emphasis on the fact that the actions within marriage are noble and worthy actions. They are truly human. They promote self-giving, this mutual gift of spouses to one another, by which the spouses enrich each other with a joyful and ready will. So here we have specific reference to the acts within marriage, the notion of marital sexuality, which is given a very high and noble and even transcendent quality. In number 50, we have a very well-nuanced reiteration of the importance of the aspect of fecundity within marriage. Marriage and conjugal love are by their nature ordained toward the begetting and educating of children, a text we've seen reiterated several times in this document. Children are the supreme gift of marriage, a text that's highlighted here in white, and then down to the text that's highlighted in white and red. Hence, while not making the other purposes of matrimony of less account, so emphasizing the interrelationship between these other purposes and not attempting to structure a notion specifically of superior inferior, the true practice of conjugal love and the whole meaning of the family life that result from it have the aim that the couple be ready with stout hearts to cooperate with the love of the Creator and Savior, who through them will enlarge and enrich his own family day by day. So the couple is cooperating with the love of God in being open to becoming parents. And this is their proper mission, the task of transmitting human life. And they thus, as the white highlighted text goes on, they are thereby cooperators with the love of God, the Creator, and interpreters of that love. But lest there be an overemphasis on the procreative aspect of marriage that implies that somehow everything else is of lesser value, then drop down to the last paragraph of this section, also highlighted in white. Marriage, to be sure, is not instituted solely for procreation. Its very nature, as an unbreakable compact between persons, demand that the mutual love of the spouses be embodied in a rightly ordered manner, that it grow and ripen. And the text goes on to particularly emphasize that you can have a true sacramental marriage even if offspring are lacking. So a well-nuanced emphasis on the importance of being parents, while at the same time recognizing that their absence does not diminish the significance of marriage. And I mean by that, their absence being the absence of children doesn't diminish the significance of marriage. And then moving on to number 51, which begins to raise the problem of contraception and other things that may inhibit true self-giving or appropriation of or appreciation of the deeper meanings of marriage. The highlighted text in yellow, God, the Lord of life, has conferred on human beings the surpassing ministry of safeguarding life in a manner worthy of human beings. I translate it that way because the text is actually homo rather than vir. It refers to the generic human rather than to individual male human beings. Therefore, from the moment of its conception, life is to be guarded with the greatest care, while abortion and infanticide are unspeakable crimes. So the council articulating classical Christian Catholic doctrine on the question of the importance of life from its very beginning, from the moment of conception. Hence, the acts themselves proper to conjugal love, exercised in accord with genuine human dignity, must be honored with great reverence. So there is both reverence and honor to the acts of human sexuality. And then notice the ordering in the text that follows from this. These acts, based on the nature of the human person and his acts, preserve the full sense of mutual self-giving and human procreation in the context of true love. But notice that there is not an insistence on always listing procreation or the aspect of fecundity first. Here, the mutual self-giving, the mutual donation is listed first and human procreation second. Again, not to say that this is implying an ordering of one above the other, but that the whole point is to highlight the interrelationship, the interdependence, the inseparability of these two dimensions. And the last point, number 52, and there isn't anything until you get to about the fourth paragraph that has a little highlight in yellow. There's a call in the council for those who are skilled in particularly the medical, biological, social, psychological sciences to assist in advancing the welfare of marriage and family, along with peace of conscience, by pooling their efforts and laboring to explain more thoroughly the various conditions favoring a proper regulation of births. It is these texts and these emphases that one will find highlighted in Humanae Vitae, the historical difficulty that we'll look at in the next section of our course is that at the same time that Humanae Vitae was being published, effective forms of contraception were becoming widely available. The intrauterine device, for example, had been available for some time. The birth control pill would become available at just about the same time as the council, and then Humanae Vitae would be published. And effective methods of natural family planning, that is, the Billings method and the symptothermal method, unfortunately, would not become widely known until sometime later. So, unfortunately, there would be a generation of clergy that were rather afraid that the church didn't have this proper explanation of conditions favoring a proper regulation of births. And we'll discuss this issue, this lag time and its historical effect in a later section of this course.